What's up? My name is Min, and it's great to be back after we took a few weeks off from the Quality Under Pressure podcast. And actually, I came into the studio today, and I forgot how to set everything up because this was the longest break we ever took from the show since we started it a year and a half ago. But man, once we started getting rolling, I remembered how fun it is. And today's conversation was the perfect way to come back because it reminded me why I love having these conversations. I get to reconnect with people, learn more about them, learn things about myself, and kind of change how I view the world. Today, we spoke with Nels Lennis, and to sum him up in the most simple way possible, I guess the easiest way is to just call him a local creative. And again, he was the perfect dude to have on for our comeback episode because he's smart, he's quick, he's well-rounded. And actually, our conversation before we even turned the mics on was very emotional. And like, I legit almost started crying, but that's Nels' story and not mine. And maybe that's a conversation we have on air a different time. But today we spoke a lot about improv. There's a fun portion in the convo where Nels asks us to define what improv is. Then he breaks down what is short form and long form improv. We talk about the rules of improv, and we talk about huge theater here in Minneapolis, which Nels helped set up. So if you're inspired to try improv after you listen to this episode, look into Huge Theater and go down to check out a show. And actually, after we turn the mics off, Nels informed me that Huge is making a big effort to think about diversity in the improv world. They want to make improv more accessible to populations that might not otherwise get into improv. And that's a wonderful thing and something I absolutely adore about Minneapolis. There are so many people trying to change the world one room at a time. Nels and Huge Theater is just a small part of this. So again, it's great to be back, and thanks to Nels for hopping on today. Welcome to the Quality Under Pressure podcast, a podcast that reminds you that a conversation is still a beautiful thing. My name is Min, joined by Dean and Leah, and today we're speaking with Nels Johan Berlennis. Did I say that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Can you explain your name? Like,
it's a super cool name.
Yeah.
It's obviously I have a lot of Scandinavian in me.
Yep.
I'm named after I have a great-grandfather on both sides of my family who's named Nels, and my dad's grandfather was actually named Nels Johan Lennis.
Yeah.
So kind of named after him.
Yeah.
But also on my dad's side of the family, there's the Burr family, B-U-R-R, which I'm told is, we're related to Aaron Burr.
Okay, nice.
Oh, wow.
Killed Alexander Hamilton. Super popular in musicals these days. So I'm somehow distantly related to him because he never had, I don't think he has direct descendants. I don't think he ever had, you know, I think he had just daughters, and I think they died fairly young.
Okay.
But somehow related to the Burr family, so that name was passed down. So I don't know why my parents thought you should have two middle names.
Yeah, it's cool, though. I like that you also, like, mentioned that it irks you a little bit when, like, Americans can't pronounce, like international names,
yeah,
for lack of a better word.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, that's interesting, because I always try to, like, get it right.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, it's hard for me, too. Like, even if I were to say, like, a Spanish name, it's never going to sound as sexy when I say it, you know? Mm. But when they say it, you're like, what? That's music. Say it again. But I just can't. I want to. I just can't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You feel like you want to do it justice, you know?
Yes.
But, like, I don't know. The only place I've ever felt like, it's weird to say, like, being a white male in America, like, I'm pretty at home here, you know?
Yeah.
But I felt very weirdly connected when I had, like, a 9-hour layover in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And people looked at my passport, and they said my name correctly, and I was in Amsterdam, like, window shopping, and a woman came up to me, and she didn't speak, I forget what, she thought I was a local. She was asking me questions, like, because I guess I also kind of look like a Scandinavian person or whatever, but just for a second, I was like, I know, I'm like, I don't have any disadvantages in America at all. Like, I've got, you know, white male, like, whatever.
You got it
that
all
covered. Yeah. But there I was like, oh, these are my people, maybe. You know?
What do people normally mess up when it comes to your name?
Honestly, it's when I say my name, they think I say something else. Because I feel like their ears aren't ready to hear Nels.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So the number one by far, when I say, hi, my name is Nels, people say in response, you'll never guess, Dallas.
Dallas?
Wait, what?
Exactly. I say hi, I'm Nels, and they say Dallas.
How?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
That's why when I first met you, I was like, I wanted to repeat it back to make sure I got it right.
Oh, nice.
And I like pictured how to spell it too to just like make it sink
that's,
in.
There you go. That's a practice I need to get better, because sometimes like I'll like meet someone, they'll say their name, and it's not that I don't care, but like I'm listening to the next thing that they're saying, mm-hmm. and their name just whizzes by 5 minutes into the conversation. Just like, oh no, I forgot your name.
And the best part is like names that are really like basic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Or whatever. Then you kind of want to substitute like, was that John? Or was
Josh,
it just like.
Or Jake. Or yeah. Whatever it was.
Jake.
Whatever. Same dude.
When I order food now, I never give my. So my ex-wife is Turkish.
Yeah.
So she's got a weird name too. And so our kids have Turkish names. So we all have weird names. But. I would never give my name when I ordered food or anything like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it'd just be like Nels.
Would you give them Dallas?
N-E-L-S. No, I would say Alex.
Alex.
Because that's the second. I forget where I was, like a fast food place, and they asked my name, and I said Nels, and they said Alex, and I said yes.
Yes. I used to do that too when we used to go to Cane's. Mm-hmm. I would just always give them a different name each time.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Okay, I should cue Nels up, though. So, Nels, you do improv. You're an actor. You're a co-founder of Huge Theater here in Minneapolis. You're a basketball fan.
Yeah.
You're a player of video games.
Yep.
So, like, that's why I was telling, like, when on the way up, Leah, I was telling Leah, like, I'm super excited because I feel like we could talk about so many different things.
Yeah.
So, before we get to the speed run question, I feel like we should touch one of those topics. How about video games?
Sure, yeah.
How long have you been playing video games?
God, how old am I? I mean, since I was, since the Nintendo.
What's your what's your go-to right now? Or like, what platform do you even play on right now?
You know, I'm mostly a PC person at this point. Like, very small stints in my life have I done console stuff.
Oh, you've always been PC then.
Yeah, even like when I was, when I was young, like at a Nintendo.
Yeah, consoles. PC gaming wasn't really
exactly. We had a PC. Yeah, we had one in the 80s, and it was like I remember playing Winter Olympics. There was a game called Winter Olympics on that PC. It was
awesome.
It
was lit.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I would say overall, I'm a PC person.
Yeah,
I like a wide variety of games, particularly like strategy and like the kind you have to. The kind that feels like homework sometimes.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Those are my favorite games too. Yeah. And now that I'm older too, I need games that have that component, but it's also a quick hit.
Mm-hmm.
So like when my friends are like, hey, you want to get this new RPG game? I'm like, wait, I have to sink in 200 hours? Like, I just can't. I just can't. So it's just like, the strategy or like the coordination piece.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I like a lot of like team-based shooters, as frustrating as it is, because you have to coordinate with a bunch of idiots. But like, I love that. I can't not do that part,
you
though.
Coordinate with people? Like, I mean,
you
Overwatch.
Like to round them all up and like get everybody on the same page.
Well, then like now when I like play Overwatch, I'm like, hey guys, like, why don't we go in and battle at the same time? They're like, fuck you, nerd. This is how the game is played.
You're brave. I like when I go in, I turn off the mic.
I have now, yeah. People are like, dude, join. Now other people are like, dude, join voice chat. I'm like, nope.
Nope.
No thanks, man. I know how that goes. Have you been on Overwatch lately?
I just started loading it up again, and there's one or two characters that I got to catch up, because I don't know how to play them.
You got to do your homework.
Who's the, I think Sigma, is that the most recent one?
He's a beast.
Yeah,
he's a beast.
Not really clear how to play that guy.
So we got to play one of these days.
Yeah.
Dean has it too.
But I have, but I'm not willing to put in the work.
I'm not. What's the, if you had to pick one game that you played for the longest period?
Well, Steam on my computer, it keeps track of that stuff. And that would be, and anybody who knows me now is probably rolling their eyes. It's a game called Crusader Kings 2.
Never played?
Yep. It's incredibly hard. It's like this simulation of the dynastic era of Europe, like dukes and kings and queens and stuff.
Yep.
And I think maybe the best way to explain it is one video game site, like PC Gamer or something like that. They said that the best Game of Thrones video game out there is this game with a mod.
Wow. Ooh,
because it is like you play as a let's say a king.
Yep.
And you play as that dynasty. So if your king ever dies, you play whoever is your successor.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of political maneuvering. And like for example, I was the king of Scotland.
Yeah.
And somebody in Scotland had a province that was going to, when they died, it would pass beyond the realm to somebody else, to another realm, which I didn't want. So I had, and I was the next in line actually to inherit that. And the person ruling that county was my 2-year-old nephew. So I had to murder him.
Yeah.
So I set up this plot and murdered him and got the, you know.
How did you kill him?
I think it was, you sort of set up a plot and then people join you and it just sort of happens. I think probably poison.
Cool. This is like.
Poison to 2-year-old.
This is Game of Thrones.
That's deep.
It really is.
You heard it, folks. Nels Lannis poisoned a 2-year-old.
He sure did.
Oh, man. That's cool, man. And that's a multiplayer game? It's a single player game.
It's a single player game, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think you can play possibly multiplayer, but it's.
That would be cool.
Extremely complicated.
How long is the game?
It starts, you can play anywhere from the year, I think, 867 all the way up to the fall of Constantinople.
So how many hours have you put into this?
Oh, over 1,000, I think.
Wow.
I think I'm getting 2,000, yeah.
So cool.
Yeah, I can't, there are concepts, that, and there are concepts in that game that I've related to improv.
Like, oh, wow. Oh. Yeah.
And it's to life, actually. It's taught me a lot of things, weirdly, about life and just the patterns that we see everywhere in all the things that we do.
Yeah, I was going to ask you an improv question, but I'm going to save it because I can probably ask you and it'll be more relevant later. Before we get to the speed round, I do want to ask you one more thing. Mm-hmm. What kind of music do you listen to?
Oh, wow. Lately, and by lately, I mean maybe the past couple of years, I kind of just sort of like surf SoundCloud for like remixes and mashups. I'm a big mashup person.
Yeah.
I love mashups. But I'm also aging out of like, I don't know the songs that they're mixing together now.
Yeah, that's me too, yeah.
But that's my jam. I love that stuff.
Yeah. I only ask because like when I first like kind of met you, I realized that you're the second person you see in the Motion City soundtrack, Look Foud, music video.
Yep.
And I was like, dude, I know that guy. And I love Motion City soundtrack. Because you're like the postman in that music video, right?
Yeah. I'm the broken heart in the broken heart video, too.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Holy shit. Okay. So I was like, do you listen to that genre or have you?
I got to know those guys weirdly before I knew their music at all.
Yeah.
I auditioned for a film Justin, the lead singer, was doing.
Yeah.
And he's like, you're perfect, and cast me. And then I was working at a restaurant and one of the people working there was dating Jesse, the keyboard player.
Yeah.
So I met him. I was like, God, I know two people from this band. I should listen to their music. And ended up really liking their music.
Good.
I really like it. And like they would, I'd get to sit in the VIP area.
Yeah.
And like one time, Justin gave me a shout out at First Ave.
Awesome.
I was in the bathroom at the time. So I ran out there. Like,
hands down.
Just
toilet
paper on the shoe. Here. Okay, I got to go back.
Butt stain. Butt
stain.
That's awesome. Does Justin still do like film stuff? Because I know like that was like his second thing that he was doing with music.
I get a text every once in a while from him saying like, I got an idea.
That's awesome. Know,
he's that kind of person.
Oh, lovely. Cool.
They just played, I think, a couple nights ago, didn't they?
Yeah,
last weekend, right?
That was last weekend. They did like 4 shows?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that,
What's that new venue? That
Fillmore,
yeah.
Oh, wow.
I'm glad that, like, that's so many of my, like, favorite bands like that, where they, like, went away for, like, 5 years, mm-hmm. and now they, like, they're active, mm-hmm. but I'm like, that's fine. Like, you don't have to tour 300 days of the year or, like, put out an album every 2 years. Like, give me an album every 5 years, even if you don't tour on it. It's, like, the ability to, like, listen and hear, like, where you are in life and get a snapshot of that. Mm-hmm. Man, I love that. I'll take that any day. Just don't break up and, like, not do it.
Never do it again. Yeah. Weird, like, weird video game Motion City connection. Justin, when he was writing one of their albums, he really wanted to write a song about an MMO, like about like World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
And I was playing World of Warcraft at the time. So we got on the phone and he talked to me for like an hour and asked me everything about World of Warcraft. Like all this, like, what's this called? What's this mean? And eventually turned it into, I don't think he used any of this stuff, but like they're still on one of their albums have sort of like a video game centric song that I feel like I had maybe a little.
Yeah.
Little
bit.
That's so cool.
Yes.
Do you remember which one that was?
Oh, I think it was on my Dinosaur Life album. I don't remember which song it was.
Sure.
Dude, that's awesome. Such a cool connection. Mm. All right, I'm going to put you through this speed round here quickly. Use your improv skills. If you had to get a face tattoo, where would it be and what would it be?
Oh my God, a face tattoo? I would get I would get the tears, but going up.
What would that symbolize?
Like I haven't been to jail, maybe, or I don't know.
But going up. Are you a morning person or a night person?
Oh, night person. 100%,
yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Which do you prefer, wheat or white bread?
I guess wheat.
Yeah.
I was raised on wheat. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't mind it.
Oh, nice. You were raised on wheat.
Raised on wheat. Yeah.
Wow. Favorite junk food.
Oh, all of it. I mean, I guess like pizza. It's hard not to say pizza and like tacos and burritos.
Mm. Oh God,
yeah, is that junk food? Is that
Is it?
Or is that just like regular food? That's my meal.
I love regular food.
Yeah,
sweet. Who is one person you would love to meet?
Oh, you know what? I would say Shaquille O'Neal.
Nice, dude.
I would say Shaq.
Yeah.
Like, there's nobody like him.
Yeah.
He's like a human being that nobody has ever been like. He's so
true. Yeah. Even like in a basketball sense. I don't know if we'll ever see another Shaquille O'Neal.
Yeah.
How many pull-ups do you think he can do right now?
Zero.
Okay.
100%.
Honest.
Yeah.
Who was your high school celebrity crush?
High school celebrity crush? Gosh.
Come on, just think back. 5 years ago now.
High school celebrity crush. The only one I can think of right now, Michelle Pfeiffer.
Nice, dude. Yeah. Is there a movie that like triggered that crush?
It was probably the second Batman movie.
I guess I
probably
would have been a
junior.
Wow.
Yeah, I guess that would be my first one. Yeah.
Yeah. If a bunch of zombie 8-year-olds came after you, how many could you take out with a bat?
Zero. I'd be running.
Oh,
I would
run.
Like zombies freak me out.
Really?
Yeah, zombie. It's a love hate thing. Like I love to watch them, but like they scare me so much.
See, I think it's a love. Yeah, it's just love.
I love
it's
thinking
just
about love. It because I'm like, dude, I could get out of this alive, like with zombies.
Like if ghosts or like vampires came after me, like I'd probably be fucked. But like zombies, I'm like, I could maybe do this.
For some reason, zombies like they give. There's like rules to them, so like you think about like how do you survive a zombie thing? You know?
Yep. Yeah.
Are they fast zombies?
Oh, yeah.
Or are they
slow,
lumbering 8-year-olds?
I feel like the slow zombie would have gone extinct if it wasn't for Walking Dead. We were on such a good like movement towards fast zombies only.
Yep.
And then Walking Dead had to insert its dumb ass. would you rather be able to talk 3 different languages or talk to animals?
Oh, I guess animals.
Nice. Yeah.
Like I could, if I really wanted to, I could learn other languages.
There you go.
But like, who's going to teach me, bird?
Yeah. I want to talk to my dog so bad. This is a good one for Nels. Would you want to live forever?
Oh gosh. I don't think that I would.
Yeah.
I'd like to meet you halfway. I'd like to live for like maybe a long time.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know, the psychology of like outliving everybody who's important to you. Like,
yeah.
I feel like you got to have real, I don't know, narcissism. I don't know what it would be.
Yeah.
But like,
or apathy. apathy. To not reach a point where you just have to stop caring.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I feel like you've thought about that. And
it's like, tough to say you don't want to live forever because imagine what you would see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But emotionally, mm-hmm. I think you're like a human brain can only take so much.
Yeah.
You know, we have 100 years worth of brain, and like, what happens when you fill 1,000 years into that brain? Like, what do you forget? What do you remember?
And I always struggle with like, if I was 80 and like facing death, mm-hmm. and somebody asked me that question, I'd be like, I need more time.
Yeah.
But it, like right now, I'm like, God, forever? That sounds awful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What is super boring to you?
What is super boring? Oh man, it's weird because I love a lot of really boring things. I guess.
Do you like baseball?
I don't. No. I don't like baseball particularly. I don't like football particularly.
I'm moving away from football too. Yeah.
Yeah.
If aliens came to Earth, what would they look like and what would they say?
Oh, man. What would they look like and what would they say? I feel like they would look like Dean. And
like Dale.
Like Dale.
It's not bad.
They look like Dean, and they'd be they just sit in the corner and like enjoy everybody's company.
Nice.
There we go.
Nice. I know the music's over. One last one. If your life were a movie, what would it be rated on Rotten Tomatoes?
What would it be rated? Like the score? Like the quality?
Yeah, the
score?
Amount of tomatoes.
I'm going to go with 80%.
Nice.
Pretty
dude.
Fresh.
That's fresh.
Yeah, I'm pretty
that's
fresh.
Yeah. Yeah, what's the threshold for certified fresh? 80?
Is it 70? 70?
I have no idea, actually.
I want to say it's 70.
Yeah. I think interesting things have happened to me. Enough interesting things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not like mind-blowing, but like I'd sit and listen to that. Yeah. Yeah.
I'd watch it. Yeah.
Watch
yeah.
It,
yeah.
I guess
too.
That's how movies work. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Watch them.
You think the critics would like you more or the fans?
Oh. Oh, man, who cares what the critics think?
Damn right. Right?
That's how you make art.
There that's right, baby. All right, let's get into your topic of the day. I'm just going to set it up as improv.
Yeah.
But let's get into, well, how did you get into improv?
Well, you guys ready for a movie?
Yeah, yes.
let's give it a tomato score.
Settle in.
So I was fairly young when I got into improv. I was about 17. And my best friend at the time in high school, he was doing, there's a traveling theater group. At the time, they're called Schizos, like skit, like doing a skit. They obviously changed that for sensitivity purposes. they changed it, I think, to the SOS Players, maybe it was. But they would go around, it's a group that would go around to different schools, and they would do little sketches about like things that are important to, issues that are important to teenagers, you know, like smoking, bullying, all that stuff. He was in that, and one of the person who ran that, my friend was in that, and the person who ran that group was friends with the person who ran what was Comedy Sports at the time in Minneapolis. So been in like the mid-90s. So he auditioned for Comedy Sports and got in, my friend. I went down there and saw him do a show, and I thought, I could do that too. And so I auditioned, and I got in, and we were both 17. And as it turns out, the person who ran Comedy Sports at the time, I'm not going to get super far into it, but like there were some legal issues there some dissent among the ranks, and like a lot of people kind of left, walked out on him. And so he had to audition and hire a bunch of new people, like a bunch of teenagers. I don't think we were working 100% legally. You know, we were under 18. But I was thrown into it. Like I would not have hired me.
But willingly, you were willingly thrown into
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I was like, cool, what's this? I was still in high school, you know, and I started performing it. He changed the name to Comedy Olympics with an X for legal reasons.
So, three X's, in fact.
Yeah. So I did that for a couple of years, and that was what's called short form improv, and that got me into it. And then there's a guy in there who's like, hey, you should do this thing called long form improv. And then I started working with him, and then just went from there, started improvising from there.
Can you describe then, because I'm totally not familiar with the world of improv, short form versus long form.
That's
what is the
exactly what
there?
I just wrote down. Because I'm familiar, but I think it'd be nice to hear it too.
Sure. It's a pretty like set like dichotomy in improv. It's really, you can really split all improv into two ways, you know, short form and long form. Mm-hmm. There's lots of different shades of that, but like those are the two main categories. Short form would be something like you would see a Comedy Sports or Whose Line Is It Anyway, or Theater Sports, I guess, is another one. Those are, it's a show where some people will come forward, so a certain number of people in the show will come forward, and then they're given a game, basically. Mm-hmm. Like they're given a structure. Like in this, okay, there's these two people, and this is explained to the audience. In this scene, Dean and Leah can only speak in successive letters of the alphabet. So like your sentence would have to start with A, and Leah's would start with B, and then C, you know. So the audience is in on what the joke is, and they sort of see what the players are trying to do. Long form improv is they just come out on stage and they don't tell anything to the audience, and you obviously have worked on what your show is mm-hmm. beforehand, but it's typically longer. It's not divided up into those little games. It's a little less digestible, I guess, which is why you only see short form on TV. You don't really see long form on TV. But yeah, I think that's probably like the big blanket explanation.
Do you have a preference between the two?
I guess I prefer long form. Yeah. I started in short form.
Yeah.
And some people, you know, look down their noses at either one of them, but I think both are just totally fine. But I gravitate towards long form, yeah.
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, not that I'm like in the improv world or anything, but there's something about, I don't know, I just always liked longer interviews like mm-hmm. this show, or just more like the content that allows you to explore a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I get it. It's like inconvenient. It takes a little bit more time, all of that. But like short form, I think it's great too. But there's a part where I think if there were a criticism, people could say it's kind of gimmicky. Mm-hmm. You could say that. But like long form, like you might not laugh for like 2 minutes,
but like they're working towards something, mm-hmm. and that's exciting to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's so like when people talk about like, oh, like you need to make like 3-minute YouTube videos. I'm like, well, no. Like, I think there's an appetite for something bigger. And I think the podcast world is kind of showing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. You'd say gimmicky. Like, I feel like there's another word to be used there because that's,
yes.
I think that's what people like about short form improv.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And like gimmick is, it's mm-hmm. got a negative connotation.
Yeah,
to it,
but I didn't mean it in like a derogatory way.
But no, right. But that's how I think that's where the derision comes from within the community. Like, oh, they're doing gimmicky stuff. They're like, well, no, that's, yes. it's part, that's the point is that they're doing fast, quick hits. Mm-hmm. And there is a structure that is known by everybody. The gimmick is known by everybody, mm-hmm. you know? So there's a better word out there, but it's hard not to say gimmicky.
Yeah. Also, I guess, okay, I'm glad that you broke down those two different categories. Can you, in your own words, like, what is, I think we all know what improv is. I think the general public knows what improv is.
This is what fascinates me.
I like hearing, even though you think you know what it is, I like hearing someone explain it because they might put it in a way that I never thought of it. So if you met, let's say you met Dean Alien that you described earlier, how would you explain improv to that alien?
Well, actually, I'd like to hear... I want to hear you guys.
Oh, sure.
First, and this isn't like not a test or anything. But like, I'm curious what
Nels is judging
because like I've thought about this for 20 years, right?
Yeah.
So like there are things that are I have blind spots too. So I'd like to hear what other people.
Somebody want to take a whack at it?
Sure. I guess my definition that I've always thought was the short form of improv. At the heart of it, like the number one rule is the yes and.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you don't stop so the story doesn't stop and it's all like, okay, how do we pick the ball back up? It's like hacky sack, got to keep it going.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I always thought it was just something that was unplanned. I don't even know if I knew that long form existed actually. I always just pictured short form, like Whose Line, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I always imagined long form though. I don't know if like I was exposed to one before the other. But I just imagine like it's almost like a Broadway play, but it's not scripted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like lights, camera, action, go. And they work off of each other and create a story. It's almost like the writing process.
Yeah.
But live. That's what improv was to me.
Interesting.
So it's like is it unfiltered writing.
Yeah. It's almost like a brainstorm, a brain dump. But like
with
physical
multiple people.
Yeah. A physical brain dump with multiple people.
Yeah. And learning how to physically brain dump. You rehearse it and practice it more and more, and then you get to be able to brain dump in ways that, like, other people that you are on your team can know, they understand what you're trying to do and what story you're trying to do. So it is still a brain dump, but it's like a focused brain dump after a while, you know?
Yeah. And like you said, there's a team component too. Like, you work off of other people because it's also like a performance,
mm-hmm.
Even though, like, I put it in like a brain dump sense. So, like, that's why when, like, you told me, like, hey, you're going to be a guest on this improv show, I'm like, dude, I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know any of you guys. Like,
so Mitt, you were in our show at Huge Theater years ago.
Yeah,
I had we asked you to be a guest at the Monday night show.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I still look back at that. It's just so fun because, like, again, I had this sort of anxiety of like, oh god, like I'm gonna go do improv. And luckily, like my job was way smaller than what you guys had to do. Mm. I just had to like sort of share life stories and then cue you guys up so you guys can actually do the heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. So like once I got there and I started doing it, I'm like, oh, this is easy. Like that's basically what I was doing in radio, just telling like 2-minute stories anyways.
That's true. Yeah. What we had you do is very radio-esque, like just standing up in front of people and just talking.
Wait,
and
so when... sorry.
So I didn't work off of anybody.
Okay.
So like that's what I was getting nervous about because I'm like, oh man, I'm going to like do improv with people that do improv and I'm going to be up there and they're going to like throw me a bone.
You're like, oh.
And I'm like, oh, yes and. And then I'm going to say like, no, that's dumb. Let's not go down that route.
Or you're just saying yes and the whole time. Yes and.
So yeah, like having that vision of the long form improv and thinking like, I'm going to show up and I'm going to have to do this brain dump and like work, feed off of the energy of the people on stage. That's what like made me scared. But once I got there, I was like, oh, this is so fun. So like, anytime I think back on that, I just like, I smile. And like anytime someone's like, oh, I'm going to Huge Theater, I'm like, yes. So, but how about you, man? What's like, so
How do you define
it? Do you think any of us were like totally off or like pretty close to what you think? Or?
No, it's, I mean, obviously, that's the thing, is the perception of the audience versus the performer, right? Mm-hmm. And the interaction I think I've gotten the most, and I think Dean kind of got to it, was like, it's all made up, right? Mm. That's kind of the general perception of like, oh, they're all making this up. Mm-hmm. And so the non-improviser will ask the improviser, like, how did you do that? And or they would say, is that all made up? And the improviser would say, yes. And they would leave it at that. But there's so much more to it than that. But the improviser is, most improvisers are happy to say, and somewhat proud to say, like, yes, we made that all up, which is true. Mm-hmm. But they also don't know that, like, they've rehearsed so many times to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And then people ask, like, how do you rehearse improv? Because you don't know what you're going to do, you know? And like the analogy I use there is like a sports team or like the military. Like you prepare for a situation.
Yep.
You know, you don't prepare what you're going to do. You condition yourself to react in a situation.
Yeah.
And so long form in particular, whatever show you're seeing, there's probably a structure, a very specific structure behind it. And in some cases, extremely complicated structure. But you as an audience member are only seeing the result, mm-hmm. right? Like making mm-hmm. a movie, you see the credits, there's 50,000 fucking people who made that movie, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work, but when you see it, it's just that you're just getting the final product, mm-hmm. you know? So yeah, there's a lot more behind the scenes that goes on, but I think the communication between improviser and non-improviser is like, yeah, it's made up, yes. So the non-improviser is like, oh, all these people just got off on the street, got up on stage and knew exactly to just improvise with each other. That's their perception of it. But in fact, there was a lot of work put into it.
Yeah. Yeah. That was my perception of it for sure. Again, like coming in, that's because that was my perception of it. I'm like, man, how are these people so good at working off of each other? But like you said, like when you put it that way, it makes total sense. Like you put in enough scaffolding before the show
mm-hmm.
and then you get to a point where like, well, if we put in more, like if we begin to fill in the meat between the scaffolding, mm-hmm, yep. This isn't improv. Then we're just like making a film or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
So you put in what you can, just the outlines and the bare bones, and then show night happens. And that's improv.
Yeah. And it's counterintuitive, I think, in a lot of ways to improvisers when they're learning, because you learn rules. Like you said, yes and.
Yeah.
Leah said, yes and. That's a rule, right? There's tons of rules in improv. Don't say no. Don't do that. You know, and a lot of the rules are don't do things, which is counterintuitive in improv when you want to be
very flexible and
exactly. But the end result is not the sum of a bunch of rules followed. It's what the rules are trying to get you to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we rehearse those rules. We rehearse what they mean to us and how we all work together. And it's maybe one of the art forms that is you put the most work into looking like you didn't put any work into it.
It's so hipster. Like you gotta act. You gotta be non-cool to be cool.
Yeah.
So, in improv too, like when I think of rules, when I learned about like filmmaking and things like that, so many of my teachers said the rules of filmmaking are there so you can break them.
Mm-hmm.
Does the same apply for improv, or is improv a world where the rules are there to make you great, so follow the rules, or are they there so you can break them?
It's a little bit of both, right?
Yeah,
I had a teacher once, long, long, long time ago, who I had a workshop with him, and he had everybody up on stage and like, you know, do some scenes, and break every single improv rule that you can think of, break them all, and we did it, and it was amazing. It was so much fun, and he's like, that's the weirdness about these rules is, it's not a mathematical, like you follow them and you'll have a good scene. Mm-hmm. It's the spirit. What is the rule trying, you know, yes and. The rule, you don't have to say yes to everything and accept everything and then move everything forward.
Mm-hmm.
You can not accept what somebody said. Like if your character's like, I don't like that. But if you innately know then how to move the scene mm-hmm. forward, instead of saying, I don't like that idea, let's do something else.
Mm-hmm.
You can still say, like Jill Bernard is one of the founders of Huge Theater. And she said something a long time ago that was really, really insightful, I thought, because they say, don't say no. But she says, don't you say no. The improviser, don't say no to their idea. People say no in real life. They see no, you know, like mm-hmm. that's a part of how you live your life. But then understanding, I'm not saying no because I'm stopping things. I'm saying no because that will forward things.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
so it's like the spirit of the law as opposed to the, like the letter of the law.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, even like when you learn more like traditional filmmaking, you learn that, you know, the camera should be steady so the visuals are appealing, but But then we know there are so many times where like a shaky camera
yeah.
is tells more of the story mm-hmm. than a camera on a tripod.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't been in the improv world, so it's like it's to hear you explain it that way. I'm like, yeah, that makes total sense. It's the spirit of the rules.
Yeah, the whole point of any rule of any art, you know, like painting, like you mm-hmm. know, stay within the lines or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
That's a guideline to get you to get used to what, you know, this general art form is like. And then once you understand that, then you can break the rules.
Yep.
Yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking, where it's like you learn the fundamentals and then you have fun with them, but you have to get that, it's kind of like that base layer mm-hmm. in, and then know the rules so you know how to break them too. Mm-hmm. Or else you're just breaking a bunch of shit and then it might look like shit.
Yeah.
Like for the lettering stuff that I do, you have to know what letter forms should look like and why they look the way they do and all that kind of stuff and the weights of them. And then you kind of play around with it. Mm-hmm. Like you get, okay, so that's where you start, and then you can kind of expand from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's hard to learn that, I think, in improv, especially for a beginner, because they're inundated with these rules. And then they feel like they should follow them. And on top of that, I feel like it's really hard to learn this art form while you're in front of people doing it for the first time, being judged by your peers, you know, whether or not they are or not. But like you feel that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a weird thing to practice because you're always sort of, you're putting yourself out there and making yourself, and a lot of times like making yourself look stupid, you know.
Mm. How early in this journey did you get like formal improv training? And I ask that because when you told me like you get all these rules applied on you early on, I can see where some people where they would be really talented at doing this, but when the rules come in and they think, oh, this is not what I thought improv would be like, where they get totally shut off and they're like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
How early on in your life did you have like formal training?
Right away, like I got a book basically right away. And when I started improv, there wasn't a lot in the Twin Cities. There was the Brave New Workshop. They were doing, you know, their sketch comedy review and they had improv afterwards. And that was kind of the only thing close to long form that I can remember. And so there weren't any theaters just doing improv. There was Comedy Sports and they did short form and that was it. So, there's a famous book, Truth in Comedy, that was written by this guy, Del Close, who's sort of considered the guru of modern improv, him and Sharna Halpern and this Howard Johnson, I think his name is. But that was sort of like the handbook of improv, and that's what I, you know, learned off of. Later on, I was able to like start traveling to Chicago and take classes down there. But I, for the most part, I haven't had a lot of training. It was just a lot of figuring it out myself because there wasn't mm-hmm. a lot of training involved. But the training is. Some people are trained, some people are not. Some people are just naturally good at it. I mm-hmm. think I was not naturally good at it. I just was doing it for a long time and then started to get used to it, you know.
So experience was your teacher, though.
Yeah, I would say so.
Which I think, hearing the way you explain like the rules and how difficult it is to strike the balance between follow the rules and breaking the rules in improv, I almost do feel like experience is the best way to learn it, because then, you hear some of these rules, but it's in action
mm-hmm.
and like you learn it as it's like being thrown at you. But if I were to like, I'm like, I'm too scared to do improv. I want to take a few classes and learn about the theory first. Mm-hmm. And then to hear like, well, here's this rule. Here's this rule. Here's this rule. Here's this rule. I think I would show up and be so stiff and be mm-hmm. paralyzed by the rules. I'd be like, oh, this is not fun.
Yeah.
So to hear the route that you went down, I'm like, I hope a lot of people do it that way.
I think if you want to say the time that I leveled up in improv, like where I felt like I was getting good at it and I understood what I was doing, was a time where I was bored with how the structure was and like doing things correctly. And I got bored and I was like, what if we start doing the wrong things? What if we start making mistakes?
Yeah.
Because then things got interesting, you know? Mm. And that's the thing, you know, young improvisers, people who are just starting out, they don't want, you know, somebody will say something on stage like, hi, mom, how's it going? And then the other person didn't hear them. And they say, oh, it's going good, mom. And all of a sudden, oh, shit, like, which one's the mom? And then people get in their head and they're like, oh, no, the audience saw this. Like, oh, what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
And they get in their head and they're like, we did wrong. We didn't follow the rules right, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas an experienced improviser would then continue on a scene where they're each other's moms. Like, who fucking cares? Yeah. You know? You know what I mean? That's hilarious. Yeah. Like, there's no wrong answer, you know? Yeah. And it's sometimes hard for people to get that right away. Yeah. But when they do, then it's... I saw an improv show a long time ago at IO, Improv Olympic in Chicago. And it was the most amazing scene. And it was a broken scene. So sometimes you say that, a broken scene where, like the one I just described, like mm-hmm. things right up front, like didn't work out. But it was a broken scene to begin with. And it was a very long scene, a very long burn. And it ended up being extremely meaningful and like kind of emotional and funny, but like heartbreaking. Like mm-hmm. it was a couple whose son had died, but he was a ping pong champion. And like, you know, the context is what it is, but like it was really brilliant. And I went up and I asked one of the people in the scene afterwards, like, as a young improviser, like, how do you do that? How did you do that? And the person said, that group is filled entirely with a bunch of people who are totally okay with what happens on stage.
Uh-huh.
And that's a tough thing to like wrap your mind around, is like, I'm okay. Because a lot of times you're not okay. You're like, mm-hmm. what do I do? How do I make this fit? What do I do? But having that sense of like, this is everything is the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Even if it doesn't make any sense, I'm going to make it make sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
That's a real, not only in improv, but like I said,
in life.
Yeah. There are things in improv where like, oh man, this is, it's dumb, but like, this is a perfect analogy for lots of things in your life.
Like, it's okay that you're not okay. It's okay that's not okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Totally.
So, okay. When you were telling it was like a slow burn and it kind of ended up coming out very emotional, but still funny. So that got me thinking, is the primary, maybe not the primary goal, because I feel like the primary goal is storytelling to a certain extent. But in terms of how you want the audience to, is it getting laughs or is it getting them to feel something like heartbreak? Can you have improv that's just like makes people like, oh my God, this is life.
I've had friends and a friend in New York who produced a show, I think it was called Harsh, where it was improvised tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a lot of people have done improv that is not supposed to be super funny. It's hard not to be funny because we just sort of have that
instinct.
Yeah, the nature of it. But lots of people have tried to do very, very serious improv. And it depends on the person. Mm-hmm. You know, like and that's another thing, getting the laughs is their early young improvisers, if they're not getting those laughs, then the anxiety meter starts going up and up and up and up, and then they start panicking. And I have to jump around and wave my arms because I got to make the audience laugh. It's hard to sit in that when it's a medium of comedy, to sit in that, like, this will pay off with a laugh later on. You know, mm-hmm. I like to think that the laughs are a byproduct of doing the good improv. It's not the point. It's the byproduct of having people watch you do something cool, you know?
Yeah.
So I like to be subtle. I like to let things burn a little bit. That's just me. Some people as improvisers, like I'm in this group, Five Man Job, and it's me and Butch Roy, who's one of the other founders, and Lauren Anderson, who's Brave New Workshop. She's been to the Brave New Workshop for years.
Butch is the guy with the hair color.
The mohawk. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. That's him. He's the executive director of Huge. Yeah. The three of us are in a group, and like, I like subtle, slow burn stuff, and Lauren will come out like a fucking hurricane and just like, she's just everywhere. And she's a brilliant improviser. Brilliant, you know, but like, it's hard not to laugh at everything she does.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like we're on two ends of the spectrum, you know, mm-hmm. but it's still, you know, it still works out somehow.
Yeah. Do you ever envy that you're not that? 'Cause to me, like, I think I'm more like you, not in an improv sense, but like maybe in a storytelling sense, mm-hmm. where like, context matters so much to me, and I feel like if I don't give that to people, so like my storytelling is often redundant, and like it just like first gear again, second gear, now we're going. And so like sometimes I feel like I'm wasting people's time, but then when I see people like that, or like when I think of like Chris Farley, it's just like instant, like it hits you so hard and it's instant. I'm like, God, like I'm like, that is what comedy is. And I get kind of jealous, but then like when I hear you explain it that way, I'm like, yeah, it's not always that though. There's different forms to getting a laugh.
Mm-hmm. And that's fun. Like when you see a group with experienced group with a fair number of people, they're all good. They're all improvising well with each other. And chances are they're all very different in their approach,
mm-hmm.
you know, but you watch a show and you're like, oh, I really like that person. I really like that person. You know, you pick out something that you really like, or I really like how these people work together, but in their styles, it's very disparate. But that, again, that's one of the things about improv is like, you know, when you'd say, get a suggestion from the audience. And I've heard people say, like, you know, that's a bad suggestion. There are no bad suggestions. Everything's going to work. Doesn't matter what you say. Mm-hmm. Literally, the suggestion doesn't matter. We'll do it. You know, mm-hmm. doesn't matter what type of improviser you are. If you're okay with everything, it's going to be good. It's going to mm-hmm. work, you know?
Yeah. So you're at a point now where you're comfortable enough where you don't compare yourself to other people that do improv.
There's still people, there's definitely people I admire and I'm like, I want to be more like that person. I want to do stuff more like that, but I'm definitely okay with kind of like I like being slow and mm-hmm. subtle. And there was actually a show I did with Five Man Job, at Huge where we were like in a prison and somebody built a wooden helicopter in wood shop and we're all going to escape or something. And there was this pervasive theme going through of, Lauren would come and give us lunches. He's like, I packed your lunch. And they always had juice boxes in them. And there's a scene where we're all getting in the helicopter and I'm standing in between the flats of the stage, you know, there's this open area. And we were talking about juice box and she gave us our lunches, you know, it's fake, it's mimed, you know. And I guess somebody in the show prior to us, she was a diabetic. So she left a juice box just sitting behind stage. Like kind of where I was standing mm-hmm. and I'd noticed it when I first came in and I was standing right there and like she gave her lunch and everybody was not looking at me and I just reached over and grabbed the juice box and started putting the straw in and everything and didn't say anything at all. Mm-hmm. And I was just like trying to let that one burn. And there's a video of it and you can hear people in the audience like laughing, like confused. And then Lauren turns around and Butch turns around and like the show kind of ended at that point because they're all like, where did that come? What the fuck happened? Like you just, and I don't think I said anything for the rest of the show, you know, but like, that's the type of thing that I like where I'm just like, I'm just going to let this burn. Or you could just come out and be like, look, I got a juice box.
Yep,
you know? Or
yep.
I took it and I'm like, if they see it, great. If they don't, I'm okay with the choice that I'm. It entertained me.
Yeah.
You know?
You know
what I mean? So like that's just me. But, you know, other people.
I know. And that's I have trouble with that, too. I think definitely when I was younger. It was like time to do like some sort of performy or like make a film thing. I feel so much pressure to make it obvious mm-hmm. Because like if you had that juice box and let's say you let it burn for like 2 to 5 minutes mm-hmm. and then you're like, I have this juice box. then the spotlight shifts to you.
Yep.
And that's kind of what you want as a performer. Like I think most people, that's what they want as a performer. Mm-hmm. But you're okay with like, I think it takes a level of humility to like have the subtle art form. And you're okay with like sitting off to the side and letting, I don't know, the story or like that slow burn almost be the main character. It's not about Nels.
Right. Yeah. It's and also the okayness of like if it doesn't work out and nobody sees it, that's okay too.
Yeah.
You know, like there's so many, like I've done things where I'm just like I'll spill a drink on myself in a scene that isn't about me, but like mm-hmm. I'll spill, oh shit, and I'll clean it up or whatever. And it may not have anything to do with anything, but I'm doing that for myself because I like it puts me into the scene a little bit more mm-hmm. and then after like and nobody will notice it but then afterwards somebody comes up and be like, I saw when you spilled your drink.
Yeah,
that was awesome, you know, like I just like doing those small things and if it fits with the whole of what's going on, great.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, that's one of the pitfalls of improv too, is like shoehorning in like, here's my idea, look at what I'm doing, this one, what are you guys doing, this one's cool too, you know.
Yeah,
shoehorning that stuff in can be tough.
Do you think being a subtle, having that subtle style has helped your film acting?
I think it kind of goes hand in hand. I think that's just kind of the person that I am.
Sure, yeah.
I feel really, everybody's looking at me. I'm feeling very narcissistic now.
Is that what you feel? Yeah.
We invited you on to talk
about you. That's true. It's my Minnesotan coming on. I've done a fair number of commercials, and yes, that's the feedback I've gotten is like, I get cast in commercials that are like, it's a very subtle look in the face or something like that. Like I gravitate towards that. I'm not a real big cartoony person, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I try to, and improv, like you got to sell things a little bit more, mm-hmm. But still compared to other people, I would say I'm a little more reserved.
Yeah. I think that translates so much better in film acting, mm-hmm. because I hate when people overact.
Yeah.
Because it's like,
it's obvious.
It's so obvious in film. Like, I don't think people can articulate it always unless like, you're watching for it, you're analyzing, you have talked about it before. Mm-hmm. But it's like, if you overact, it's like, am I watching Dumb and Dumber? Or am I watching like an Oscar award movie?
Yeah, yeah.
And so like, I just feel like the little things, like when someone's like feeling anxiety in a scene and it calls for like an eye twitch. Yeah, everyone can kind of, but eventually it's going to look like a wink.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And like people,
exactly.
Like bad actors will like, and wink and twitch. But when you almost don't notice it and you just feel, you don't even have to like see it, but you feel the eye twitch, then you can feel that character's anxiety and it's not obvious and it's almost more mysterious and more meaningful. And so like hearing you say like, yeah, man, that's actually, yeah, like what one, it's a part of who you are. It's your natural personality. But to see that on screen is, yeah, that's, it's just, it's different. It's special.
Yeah,
that totally made me think of, and I don't know if this is what you're referring to, but in one of the recent Star Wars films, Adam Driver playing Kylo Ren, it's like there's a scene, it's close up on his face, but he has like, it's the way his lip, like his lips were turned in a certain way, and he did do like some kind of eye twitch, but it was just that very subtle, you can see it if you're looking for it later, but as you're just watching the movie, like watching a movie, it's more of a subconscious level that you, and then it's, yeah, it's that subtlety. But if he was like, you said, Stan, like forcibly twitching an eye, it'd be a totally different scene.
Yeah, the really good actors like that, they, yeah, they can draw you in and make you interpret what they're doing instead of you shielding yourself from the loudness of what they're like. Yes, I get it. Your eyes twitching and you're yelling, you know, but like drawing you in like, oh shit, something's going on in his brain. You know?
Yes.
That's what I say about acting. I've heard that before about like the hardest, one of the most, or hardest or most important, I forget, like in film is listening to the other person when, you know, in a scene and staying in the scene and you're only forced to react in subtle ways. And it's, sometimes that's very hard to do, you know? And, but some people, Adam Driver is like, fantastic at it, you know.
Yeah,
I remember like in college films when I was unfortunately asked to act,
and I had
to do like a little face thing. Like I would always do it twice. I would do it once, and I'm like, I don't know if that translated on camera. Yeah. And I would think that I don't think you can be in your own head about the process when you're acting. Like it has to just flow through you. So I would like do it, and then I'm like, I don't think the camera saw it. So then I would do it again. And it looks so horrible. I was just like, I am not.
Well, that's the thing, like improv and film, like I think like some of the best things and moments are those serendipitous things that are captured, right? Like on film, they really nailed it in a natural kind of way. And no other takes were like that. And improv is very much a you had to be there art form, right? Because you're never going to see that moment again. And it was only perfect because of the culmination of everything. And that's also one of the things improvisers have a hard time getting into in the beginning is, I can say this like as a audience member, when I was young and I was seeing people who are way better than me, and like I see them on stage and they would just make an eye, or they would say like hamburger, and that would bring the house down because contextually that was a very, very funny thing to say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as a young improviser, I'm looking at them, I'm like, I can say hamburger. Right. You know, like, why can't I? What they're doing looks, you know, to go back to tennis. Nels tennis. When I was in high school, I played tennis, and I always found it very frustrating because the net is what, 2-3 feet high?
Sure. Is it really only 3 feet high?
I mean, it's really short. It's like waist high. Right? Okay. On me, it's like waist high. And you have the entire fucking sky to get the ball over. But I still hit that net. I'm like, oh, what happened? Yeah. And I see improviser like, that dude just came on stage and he just said hamburger. Like, I can do that. But there's so much more behind it. You know, he knew that he or she knew that that was the right thing to say at the right time and the exact time, you know, stuff like that. So I don't know. I'm rambling, but it kind of comes back to like the, it looks easy, but it's.
I want to ask you, because you brought up, oh, did you have a question to you?
Yeah, sure. Nels, going back to your five-man group, when you guys formed that, was it kind of like building a starting lineup for like a basketball team where obviously you want chemistry, but were you looking for like certain performers that had certain attributes? Like, you know, we need a 7-foot guy tall who can give us 2 points when we need it. You know, we
that's
need
why
a four
they brought
general.
Me in. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
For the rebounds.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a rebound monster. No, actually, five-man job has gone through several iterations.
Okay.
I wasn't even in the first one. I'm in this most recent one. But that group, like a lot of groups, are formed through chemistry. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of shows we do at Huge where we have auditions. And like, it's our job to see who works, who understands what we're doing, who works together, these people, that's great. Some of the best groups, they're not formed through auditions. They're just friends, you know, and the reason they're so good is because they know each other so well and the chemistry is already there, you know. So it's a little half and half. There are some groups that are formed like, we need this person, we need this person, not necessarily for like, you know, the specific things that they do, but like they would work well in our group, you know, and like there is a little mechanicalness to it, a little mathematicalness to it. But then there are other groups where it's just, there's so many groups that are formed out of classes, like a group of people who are in a class together. And then they're like, oh, let's just form a group because we already know each other really well and we have chemistry, you know? And that's the kind of thing that like with the two, there's a duo that I think is considered maybe the best improvisers in the world. They're called TJ and Dave, TJ Jagodowski and Dave Pasquazi. And they're from Chicago and they just do a two person show. And they're, whatever it is between the two of them is transcendent. Like it's so, it's so good. And it wasn't, that wasn't like constructed, you know, it was just those two guys found each other and all of a sudden they're doing this super deep, super funny and just like great improv. So the chemistry, I think, is such a huge part of it all.
Yeah.
There, so a two-man group and then the five, is there like a max number of people to be involved where it just like, where it just like falls apart because there's too many cooks in the kitchen?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And funny thing, five man job is three people, which is confusing.
I had a silhouette in my head of five heads.
I think Butch named the group. I think it was a reference somewhere in Reservoir Dogs. It's Reservoir Dogs.
Cool.
Oh,
cool.
Okay.
I do like it more now. Yeah,
but it was always three people, which is confusing. But yeah, that's definitely a thing. You know, there are some groups like you. And it depends on the group. Like you can see 10 people on stage, and like each person, you know, they contribute just right. But yes, 100% there are times where it's like there are too many people on stage. There's too many people in this group. In the last, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, I would say duos have gotten more popular. Because, you know, it used to be a very scary thing to be. If you're in a duo, you are in every scene all the time.
Yeah.
And so that's scary. But then people sort of come to realize like, well, then I have a lot of opportunity to really connect with this person and really like just the two of us and make this really cool thing.
Yeah. And I hearing you, we made the basketball analogy too. And I can see like where even if it was a 10 person group, having five Nelses, that was a lot of S's there, would be fine because like you said, like you don't mind fading into the background every once in a while and then coming up when you need to come up. So it's like if you have 10 people, but five people are willing to do that, you have two drivers, and then like, and then people come in and out. Then who cares how many people you have up there?
Yeah, if the chemistry is right between 10 people,
I suppose if you had 10 or even 5 people who all wanted that spotlight to be the showstopper person, that'd be a lot harder.
Yeah, it can, or maybe that is
or
exactly
totally wild.
Maybe it works. Yeah,
yeah.
You know,
right.
It's a weird, sometimes a guessing game, like who will go with who and like what chemistry will, you know, work and what doesn't. But yeah, I would say the average is probably between 2 to 6 people per group, I think.
Yeah. I wanted to kind of shift to Chicago too, because you brought that up a couple of times, but before I was originally going to shift there, I just wanted to like kind of encapsulate this whole conversation about rules. I think what I, hearing you speak over the last 20 minutes or whatever, I think what I've learned and appreciated about you is that you've kind of become a master of the rules. And I think that's when something special happens. Because like even going back to film, I think master filmmakers are someone that has control over the rules and the rules don't have control over them. And they know when to break it. They know when to apply it correctly. And so to hear you talk about improv this way, that's very much the sense that I get from you. And that's why I think you're able to articulate, but also when you perform, you're able to weave in and out of those things. So I think that's awesome.
No,
one. But then Chicago, you said you spent some time training there. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's a big improv scene in Chicago, though, right?
Yeah. Because
that's like where Colbert and like some of his homies come from.
Yeah.
And,
okay. It's considered like a mecca of improv. You know, it's kind of where modern improv was born. That's where Del Close was. It started in the 50s with the, I'm going to get this all wrong, but it was like the Committee Players. It was this theater group. Joan Rivers was a part of it too.
That's right, yeah.
They started doing improv to like create content, and then that became more of a thing. And then, you know, the Second City in Chicago, that's, you know, one of the originators of, there's a lot of, you know, improv artists that came out of there, and Improv Olympic. And yeah, it's sort of the epicenter of all this, this modern improv. Because, you know, like hundreds of years ago, there's obviously like different art forms like Commedia dell'arte, which is, you know, like improvised clowning, or not clowning, but like it's, you know, older, but like modern improv,
yeah, yeah.
You know, is it's a much newer art form, and it definitely started to grow in Chicago. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any sense like how, like why Chicago was the destination? Because I also, like, when I hear people that have been in the stand-up comedy game, they always talk a lot about the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And then improv somehow is Chicago. Do you have any sense, like, what was the nutrients in the air in Chicago that fed improv?
I think a lot of it had to do with this person, Del Close, who was, okay. He's a Chicago guy, right? And he was eccentric, I think, to say the least. Like, he was really crazy guy. But his ideas are really great, and, you know, it's one of those people, like, I don't think he would have survived today, because, like, he was
he would have got canceled?
No, he would have, okay. Like,
okay. It's not that.
Lawsuits. He would have had lawsuits.
Oh, okay.
Like,
okay.
You know, he was very mercurial and very mean and very, like,
okay.
Yeah.
Controversial?
Yeah, yeah, in ways.
In today's.
Yeah, he would not be, yeah, it would, things, I don't know, I'm speculating, but like, it worked back then.
You guys were boys.
Yeah, he was a mad genius. Yeah. You know, and like, actually a good friend of mine was his caretaker late in life, as he died in 1999, I think, but he was his caretaker, and then wrote a book about his last days with this guy. It's mm-hmm. called Guru. It's a very good book. But I think that was part of it, like the air in Chicago was this sort of, this guru person, you know, yeah, and yeah. Things grew from there. And now Chicago is still very much like an epicenter of improv, but you see this ton, it's all over the country, but like New York and LA, they have their scenes. Improv now, in a lot of ways, is a avenue to get onto TV or movies, mm-hmm. right? Because you see a lot of the comedy people you see today, a lot of them are from like the UCB, the Upright Citizen Brigade Theater. And then people started saying like, oh, that's how you get on Saturday Night Live, is you go to this theater and you get trained and then you go somewhere, you know. So mm-hmm. the people in Chicago, I think, are the people who are still doing it for the love of improv.
Nice.
And the people in New York and LA, not to take anything away from them, there's definitely people there doing it just for the love, but like, that's where you get cast and things, you know. And sometimes improv is a means to an end, which is totally fine, mm-hmm. you know. But yeah, Chicago is still kind of that heart.
Yeah, I like that. I'm usually a purist about things too. And so to hear that Chicago still has that, like, even when it comes to basketball, okay, like crossovers and step back three-pointers are fun, but what about like setting a good screen and getting someone open? Like, I'm a purist that way still. So, oh man, I know we're running out of time here too, but I really wanted to talk about Huge Theater before we wrapped up. So, I don't know, so you're a co-founder.
Mm-hmm.
When did the idea pop up, and like, what was that journey like to make it an actual place?
Well, it was, so we have this thing in Minneapolis, the Improv Go-Go. It was a Sunday night show. And that was something that was created by Butch, in, I believe it was late 2001, maybe. And that was just a Sunday night show at the Brave New Workshop when it was on, in Uptown. And, it was $1, and it's still $1. It's always been $1. It's actually pay what you want now. But it was only ever $1. And the idea was, we started seeing, there was more and more improvisers popping up around that time, and like groups kind of popping up. So Butch is like, let's do the Sunday night show where we have four groups. Each group gets 20 minutes and it'll be $1 and it'll be great. And it became very popular, and more people started doing it. And then the improv scene started to grow. Mm-hmm. Just the Sunday night, that's where all the improvisers were. And we're like, well, all these people now, like, we have this community now.
Mm-hmm.
And so Butch and Jill and myself and two other guys, Mike Fotis and Joe Bozick, got together as we were sort of like motivated, I guess. And so like, let's try to create something. And we decided to create Huge Theater, and it was a concept, and it started in 2005.
Okay.
And we would produce shows, like we did the old Arizona Theater. I don't know if you know where that is. It's hard to get to because it's, you know where the Kmart is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In Uptown?
Yeah.
It's on the other side of that.
Okay.
Oh. So real hard to find. You got to go around. But we would produce shows. We'd produce a weekly show there. We did a weekly show at the Varsity Theater, and it was all produced by Huge, you know. And it was similar to Improv A Go-Go, and we started branching out and trying to create new improv shows. And then in about 2008 or 2009, around there, we started getting serious about finding a place, discussing it, and it was funny. Butch was driving around and he's like, God, you know, I'd love a place in the, you know, it'd be the perfect place is the Lava Lounge. That would be just perfect. And, you know, on 31st and Lindale. And then Lava Lounge went up for sale. We're like, shit. And so now that's where Huge is.
Yeah.
It was really fortuitous. But we opened in late 2010, I think, was our first first show there. And the, at that point, you know, like I said, we had produced shows and like the community was getting bigger and bigger. And now there was a place for this community to be. You know, like there, I mean, there's obviously other theaters, there's Comedy Sports, there's, you know, Stevie Ray's, Brave New Workshop. People in the community do all of those. But Huge was the only one dedicated to long form improv. And I think that attracted people and gave them a home for, you know, all the stuff that was happening with Improv Go Go. And we've been going ever since.
That's so cool.
Yeah, that is so cool.
I love how it just like, it started small and then it just grew because it was the community's love for it. And they just ended up gravitating together.
And that's how we really try to run Huge is like, it's a nonprofit and it's not the people who run Huge. It's not our theater. It's the community's theater. Because they're the people you're going to be performing. You're going to be working there. You're going to be volunteering. Like, this is your theater. So I'm very proud and very happy that Huge was created and opened and continues to go because of a need that was being filled, not because we wanted to create a thing that didn't exist. You know, the group, the community was there. And so that was a result of the community.
How did you come up with the name Huge?
I think it was at the time Jill had, she had a little, teaching business kind of like where she would do improv workshops, but they're very few and far between. And she called it Tiny Improv. And then somebody was like, well, we should be Huge Theater.
Nice.
And it worked.
Yeah. Yeah.
For a long time, our working title was Actual Improv Theater.
Yeah.
Which turned out it was just too hard.
Are you going to do anything like, so if you've been in the space since late 2010 with the first show, are you doing any kind of 10-year celebration?
So it was the end of 2010. So it would be the end of this year. I'm not sure yet.
I guess
it has been 10 years. Well, it's also weird because we were kind of in the middle of a capital campaign earlier this year to move out of that space.
Okay.
So like that took up a lot of our time, but we have an anniversary show every year.
Yeah.
Where we get all the improvisers in and do, you know, a ton of improv and we should.
That story was so easy. Was the journey actually that easy to, from like brainstorming to finding a place to launching a place? Was it actually that easy?
No.
Okay.
No, there's a lot of work, a lot of, you know, and my first child was born like the year before we opened. And so like, we were all sort of that age, like Butch had already had kids.
Uh-huh.
But like, there was just a lot of, we were at that age where like, there are more things in our life, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of sweat equity put into it and a lot of work. But again, it was easy in a sense that we weren't like searching for people to be a part of this. Like they were waiting waiting for it to open.
Was it like, is that Field of Dreams? Build it.
If you build it, then they will finally have some place to go.
Yeah.
So if people want to, let's say there's a young Dawson out there and he's like, ooh, I would like to do improv. Andy Dawson, our other co-host that wants to get into comedy. How do people find out about Huge? And then what are some opportunities that they might be able to find through Huge?
Well, hugetheater.com is the easiest way. All the info's on there. We have classes, shows. Coming and seeing shows is, I would say, I don't know, 100% of how people get into, improv, because they see a show and they're like, I can do that, or I want to do that.
Yeah. They think they can do that.
hugetheater.com lists all of our shows. We have, on Thursday nights, we have a thing called Space Jam, which is...
sounds awesome.
I'm a fan because of the name.
I don't even need to hear more. Yeah.
It's an open jam. So literally anybody can come in, sign up, and we get, say, like 25, 30 people there. Then you'll be split up into 10 or 10 groups, three groups of 10 people.
Yeah.
And everybody else sits in the audience, and those 10 people just do improv for a while. And there's a host. And there's also a special guest of, there's somebody who runs it, who does the improv with them, you know, kind of experienced. And then there's a special guest each week who is a very experienced improviser. So everybody, these three groups get to go up and try improv. You don't have to have any experience. And also there are one to two people there who are very experienced who will help, you know, help things stay on the rails and like, you know, help people along. So that's a really cool way to do it if you feel gutsy, you know.
That sounds terrifying, actually.
That's so awesome.
Yeah. So many of our improvisers, like nine random people that I'm with.
So many of our improvisers have come through that.
Oh, wow.
And there's people who are like, that's my show. Like, they just do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's a great way to do it.
Yeah, I could, for sure. It sounds terrifying to me, but I'm sure like a couple things go right. I'm like, man, I loved it. It's so fun. I got to do it again and again and again. I can see how it snowballs real fast.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Great.
That feeling is, yeah, that's a good feeling.
Yeah, man. Oh, I'm so bummed. Like, we're running out of time, so I'm bummed that we can't talk about basketball. We'll just have to have you come back on one of these times, and we'll do a deeper dive on basketball. We didn't even talk about your acting that much.
Yeah, we didn't.
Yeah. And I know you said it's on pause for a little while, too, but, like, yeah, once, I don't know, like, once maybe it gets back going, too, like, we'll do a deeper dive into that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Commercials and films and whatnot, yeah.
Yeah. What's the latest, like, commercial that you've done?
Oh, it's been a while. The latest one that's been airing, I think, in the last couple of months, there was a commercial for Cenex.
Okay, I've seen that one.
You've seen that one?
Yeah. That's what I would have guessed, too.
Yeah, I think that's the most recent one.
Yeah. What was on the TV in that commercial that you didn't want the spoiler for?
Oh, some sports. Like,
okay.
You know, they obviously, they can't use, like, licensed teams or whatever. Okay. Yeah, so it was just like, I'm not supposed to hear whatever the score of the game is.
I just know anytime, because it cuts, I think you can see like a TV in the background or something. And like every time that commercial comes on, I'm like, I'm going to see what he's trying to avoid. I never catch it. So that's funny. Cool, man. Well, thank you so much for coming on, sharing your entire story with improv, teaching us too. I think that's my favorite thing. Like when I walk away and I'm like, oh man, I learned something. And I can feel like that. Also, like what you said, you can apply it to your life.
Yeah.
Like that's a huge gift. So.
Yeah. God, I have so much more to talk about.
So many more so gifts many more to things, give. Yeah. Santa Claus over here. Cool, man. Thank you again.
Thanks. This is really great to be here. I appreciate it.
Yeah. You can connect with the Quality Under Pressure podcast on Twitter at QUP Podcast, Instagram, and Facebook at Quality Under Pressure. And you can send us an email at qualityunderpressure@gmail.com. I think it's been a while since I talked about
that. That's right.